This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Another good month for job creation.
What could go wrong?
From APM American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, March 9th.
Coming up, we'll dig into this morning's jobs report.
Greece passes a major hurdle in the debt crisis, but now another potential problem looms.
And we all scream for ice cream, even after 7 p.m.
Well, I already knew that. Those stories and more are just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
The big news this morning is the February jobs report from the Labor Department. U.S. employers added 227,000 jobs last month, and previous estimates for December and January were revised upwards. The unemployment rate remains at 8.3%.
Now, to get a little deeper into the numbers, we've got Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, who covers the job market for us. He joins us now. Mitchell, what else does this morning's report say?
Well, Jeremy, there's a lot to like here if you're an economist or you just started looking for a job. Temp employment was up by 45,000. It's the most in 2 years. Employers just can't get much more work out of their current employees, so they hire temps, and a lot of those people will eventually get hired on permanently. We had manufacturing up again by 31,000. Government was flat, which may not sound so good, but we were losing about 25,000 jobs a month right. All through 2010. And as tax revenue stabilized through the recession, the smackdown of government employment may be ending.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, thanks a lot. And now for some analysis, let's bring in our regular Friday guest, Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial. Chris, what do you make of these numbers?
Well, look, you know, everything in this report looks just super. And it's important to emphasize there are two surveys that take place every month, one of businesses, the other of households. As Mitchell said, the business numbers looked really good. The household numbers did, too. Households reported that they managed to find almost 500,000 more jobs this month, which is super. The unemployment rate wasn't down. It was stable at 8.3%, but even that, it contains some good news. The reason it was stable is that despite the rise in employment, the labor force also grew, and that means people are more confident about jobs, too.
Well, how long is it going to take for us to get down to what would be considered, at least what used to be considered, a normal unemployment rate of about 4.5%?
Oh, my. It's going to take a really, really long time. There are still 6 million people who lost their jobs in the recession looking for work. And at the current rate, 200, 250 or so, finding jobs every month, but, of course, the population growing at the same time, it's going to be 2020 before we see unemployment rates like that again.
And, Chris, the one thing that derailed our recovery before was the debt crisis in Europe. I saw this morning that Nicolas Sarkozy, the president of France, has come out and said the Greek debt crisis is over now because of some bond swaps that went on.
Yeah, absolutely. He did say that. And then about 10 minutes later, the Greek prime minister was out saying, even after the swaps and even with the planned rescue, we're still going to need another 10 billion euros or so. So I think that story is going to stick around for a while.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial. Thanks as always.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
For another take on this, we've got Alan Krueger. He chairs the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Good morning, Mr. Krueger.
Morning.
So, Mr. Krueger, do job numbers like this give you and your boss, who is the president, a sense of relief?
You know, I think today we saw another solid jobs report. I don't know if relief is the right word in the sense that the unemployment rate is still 8.3%. I don't think the president will feel relieved until every American who wants a job can find one. But I think it gives a sense of confidence that we're heading in the right direction, that the actions that the president has taken are leading us out of the deep hole that the economy was in when he took office.
Well, one interesting note on the numbers that you mentioned was that the unemployment rate held steady at 8.3%. The economy did add jobs. And what that indicates is that there are people who are re-entering the workforce if the unemployment rate didn't drop. I'm wondering how much of a worry that is, the idea that there are a lot of people kind of in the sidelines and that maybe the unemployment rate doesn't reflect the number of people who actually want to work.
I think the key thing to keep focused on is the number of jobs being created each month. And both the establishment survey and the household survey showed strong job growth in February. The labor force increased by almost 500,000 people in February. That's a big increase. Interestingly, it looks like the increase was largely a result of people remaining employed. You know, every month people move from employment to out of the labor force. They return to school, they retire. And last month, it looks like the numbers were primarily affected by an increase in the number of people who remained employed from one month to the next.
And other than the employment numbers, what parts of the economy are you watching right now?
Good question. We're looking at a lot of indicators. You know, we're looking at exports, but we're continuing to see exports expand, and we're on track to meet the president's goal of doubling exports over a five-year period. We're also closely monitoring the housing sector. Housing was ground zero for the financial and economic crisis. In the housing boom years, we overbuilt housing. Then, since about 2007, there's been relatively little housing construction going on, we're focusing closely on what's going on in residential real estate markets, construction more generally. One of the reasons why the president proposed additional investment in infrastructure is to put more construction workers back to work. That will help the economy today and also help it in the future. If we have improved railroads or ports or highways, that'll help productivity in the future.
Alan Krueger chairs the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Alan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, as the job market improves broadly, more Americans are likely to start looking for new jobs, even if they're already working. Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell is here now with some job hunting tips for the employed and the unemployed. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So have the best ways to hunt for a job changed in this economy?
No, I don't think so. You know, it's well established. Lots of research shows that, you know, 50% or more jobs come from connections, family, friends, former colleagues. And so I think in the downturn, that was probably an even stronger effect. But here's what has changed. Technology. Technology makes it much easier to build and maintain your network, these connections. If you think about LinkedIn.
Yeah.
So that is a really good move with this economy.
Although I was just talking to a boss recently who said that he actually pays more attention now to an old-fashioned resume that's delivered in the mail because he gets so few of them. Everything's online now.
Yes, but you hang out with a bunch of curmudgeons. And so I'm not exactly surprised that there's a little retrograde feeling going on there. But in general, I do think for the person that's trying to maintain their network, LinkedIn and other technologies makes it easier to maintain it and build it. It doesn't create it for you.
All right. What about people switching jobs? Is the economy now good enough for people who have been sitting in jobs that they don't love to get up and go and apply for other things?
Okay, we can't get carried away. I mean, the unemployment rate is still high, but I also don't want to recommend that anyone stay in a job that they don't like. So here's the thing, fair or not fair, employers, future employers, prefer to hire people who have a job. So what I would be doing right now in this economy, where do you want to go? Start nurturing that network. I would be going for that job, but keeping your current one until you get an offer.
Chris, does the fact that a lot of people have been staying in jobs that they don't love had an effect on the broader economy?
Oh, I think it has. You know, there's lots of surveys, Jeremy, that come out that, you know, people are increasingly dissatisfied with their job and there's job lock going on. I'm staying with this job because I need my health care benefits, that kind of an effect. And here's where I think the real economic effect is going to be going down the road. There's going to be a wave of people when they're more confident, They're going to say goodbye to that employer for the last time. It's going to be a big brain drain. Employers are going to be struggling with employees that can leave.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Now to the Marketplace Global Perspective. Greece has passed another do-or-die hurdle. Private investors have agreed to write off about 75% of their loans to the country. The deal should clear the way for a second bailout, which will allow Greece to avoid a messy default. That's good for Europe, but it may have consequences in a more obscure market, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
When investors buy government bonds, they can take out an insurance policy, usually from a bank. They're called credit default swaps. Remember them? They played a starring role in the mortgage meltdown. In this case, if a government defaults, the investor can claim on this insurance and get much, if not all, of their money back. Today, the international body that oversees these policies will decide whether the Greek debt deal is technically a default. Greece says it isn't, because it's mostly voluntary. But Stephen Lewis of Monument Securities says that would terrify thousands of other government bondholders.
I think investors will wonder under what circumstances any sovereign borrower could be said to have defaulted.
He says it would be like a homeowner suddenly discovering his house is not covered for fire just as the flames get uncomfortably close. It could hit confidence in a whole range of other government bonds. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
So Greece will get more euros in a new bailout. Well, in another part of Europe where they don't use the euro, they're burning through cash, literally. From Budapest, Hungary, here's the BBC's Nick Thorpe.
In a suburb of the Hungarian capital, behind barbed wire fences bristling with security cameras, stands the cash centre of the Hungarian Central Bank. Almost all the $7.5 billion worth of Hungarian banknotes in circulation pass through here annually to make sure they're clean, untorn and suitable to be used to buy and sell things. One in four bills are judged unfit and shredded. Barnabas Ferenczi, director of cash logistics, showed me round.
But you can also see small shreds of banknotes flying around like if it was snowing.
And this is your favourite part of the process?
Yeah, this is my favourite spot. I can really feel how we actually destroy banknotes.
The shredded bits are then crushed into briquettes at high pressure, each containing about $30,000. And they're donated to charity as fuel. This year, two children's homes won the open tender and saved thousands on their heating bills. In Budapest, I'm the BBC's Nick Thorpe for Marketplace.
This weekend marks the anniversary of the earthquake and tsunami and subsequent meltdown of Japan's Fukushima nuclear plant. Scott Tong was there for us last year and revisited for this report.
They only eat vegetables.
A year ago, Nori Kodama walked me down a Tokyo street, lamenting what he called herbivore men. They're risk-averse, wimpy.
They're getting kind of weak. I mean, their preference is not to be like manly men.
So after the tsunami, he vowed to be a bold carnivore man. He quit his job at a multinational last summer, started his own company.
Everybody thought this is a bad idea.
Nori was 39. His wife was expecting.
She was very worried, but she knows she cannot stop me.
To chase his dream, he started a firm to help others find theirs. It trains young professionals to discover themselves and improve their English. One session requires them to recite a famous speech out loud.
I have a dream.
Don't afraid to make mistakes. You know, now we need that kind of attitude after the earthquake. Be foolish, like Steve Jobs. Take off your pants.
Take Off Your Pants is the title of Nori Kodama's new book. It's about how he came to America at 20 and learned enough English to get a Harvard MBA and win a national buffalo wing cook-off. The serious point is Japan Inc., he says, needs to reboot, try new things.
I'm sure that a lot of big companies will suffer big time. and new industry or new companies have to emerge in order to sustain this Japanese economy.
Japan has reinvented itself before. In the 1800s, it sent scholars out to engage global ideas. After World War II, the founders of Sony and Honda stoked another miracle. Do they have one more in them?
We have some switch, I guess. When we have a crisis, that switch turns on. We have a lot of energy.
The confident words of a Japanese manly man. In Tokyo, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, tell me, take us back, if you will, in time to your college dorm. Tell me a little bit about what your dorm was like.
Let's see. It was, I lived in a couple of different dorm rooms, but they were all kind of small and, you know, just a little tiny twin bed, which I will never have again, thankfully. And, you know, maybe a TV, I think, in one place I might have had a TV, a computer, and that's about it.
Broken lamp, sound familiar?
Broken lamp, of course, yeah.
Well, there's a senior in Ohio University who installed a hot tub in his dorm
room.
Whoa. I know. This was not your average dorm room. And the hot tub was not your average hot tub. Kevin Linehan was the guy, and his hot tub held 200 gallons. It had jets, temperature controls, you know,
the
whole.
How did he fit that into the room?
Well, it was inflatable somehow.
Oh, I see.
He
okay.
rigged this up himself.
I see.
And he had it going for a little while, but it's apparently illegal, according to the university.
Uh-huh.
And they made him drain it.
Oh.
And this is my favorite part. When asked why he put a hot tub in his dorm room, Linehan said he was a marathon runner and liked to relax his muscles after a long
run. Oh, yes, of course. That's right. That makes a lot of sense.
That's why they have it on the Jersey Shore, too.
The cost of the federal food stamp program has doubled since the recession. 45 million Americans are now getting food assistance, and a recent report found evidence of fraud in the system. That was the topic of a hearing on Capitol Hill yesterday, as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
The Agriculture Department estimates illegal food stamp schemes cost taxpayers $330 million a year. For example, stores sell prohibited items like liquor or tobacco in return for food stamp cash. Despite electronic tracking, fraud can be difficult to uncover. At yesterday's hearing, Pennsylvania's Inspector General Kenya Faulkner said some bars will accept food stamp cards and then take the cards to a local grocery store.
You never really see the bar restaurant transaction. What you see is the recipient using to buy $200 worth of groceries at this particular grocery store. That's a little hard to track.
Committee members, including Chairman Daryl Issa, called for tougher enforcement, but without any extra money.
In fact, you're going to have to do more for less. More oversight, more accountability.
House Republicans are backing a budget that would cut $127 billion from food stamps over 10 years. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Today, the South by Southwest Festival kicks off in Austin. It's long been known as a big music scene where independent bands get discovered. But this year, the festival's technical side is getting a lot of attention. Jeff Tyler reports.
South by Southwest is like three events in one: music, film, and technology. More people register for the interactive festival, even though it's the most expensive of the three at $950. Hugh Forrest is director of the interactive festival. He expects lots of entrepreneurs will introduce new companies.
While the general economy is still fairly sluggish, the startup economy is very robust.
Austin hotels sell out months in advance, says economist Angelos Angelou.
Not even half of the people that come to Austin are able to be accommodated in area hotels.
He says that creates an opportunity for local entrepreneurs.
I know of a lot of people, particularly empty nesters, that if they have an extra room or so in their home, they rent it.
Last year, festival organizers say South by Southwest brought $175 million into the local economy, and they expect this year will be even more profitable. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
A new report out finds that teenagers are spending a little more time watching TV, and maybe some of the assumptions we've had about all the time that they've been spending watching other devices like iPads and computers and Netflix and Hulu and YouTube and everything else might not be right. Todd Younger is a senior analyst with Sanford Bernstein, and for today's Midday Extra, he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, so tell us, what did your report find? Why are kids watching so much TV, and how much more are they watching?
Well, you know, what's interesting is it's not something new that I stumbled upon that was never known before. It's just I think the conversation has gotten so hyped up about all the new devices and all the technology, and kids must be doing nothing but, you know, Facebooking and iPadding and spending time in their room. The data was out there. It has been out there for some time. Teens have watched TV. Adults watch TV. They continue to watch more TV. And I thought it was just important to remind people that this is still going on and some of the hype is perhaps overblown.
Well, Todd, you know, there are only so many hours in the day. You can't obviously watch 10 hours of TV, 10 hours of Netflix, and then go to school for 8 hours. Although, you know, you could probably come close if you're 15. So is this TV taking the place of other things? Are these going on simultaneously? What are teenagers doing?
Well, so that's a great question because, right, the laws of physics have not been changed. And in my report, I also talk about it. It is certainly true that teenagers are using more devices, and I point to some data that they're using more apps, more devices, more electronic gadgets than us older folks, and that is true, but it is not coming at the expense of TV. So the specific data shows that since 2004, for instance, teens have been watching traditional TV as we know it and increasing that consumption at a rate of about 2.5% a year, which is not giant growth, but it's not going down, and it's a large number. It was a little over 3 hours in 2004, and it's crept up closer to 4 hours per day, every day, in front of the TV set now in 2011. The other stuff they're using seems to be additive in sort of a multitasking sort of way, so maybe there's a stereotype that is somewhat true. And in fact, the notion that teens are shutting off the TV and then going in their room to spend time on Facebook is probably not right at all. It's probably they're still in front of the TV while they're on Friends with Facebook. And frankly, they're probably talking on Facebook a lot about what they're watching on TV.
How do these numbers compare to what adults are doing?
So adults do watch more TV than kids. We've been watching more and more TV every year as well, about 2.6% more TV every year, and it was a little under 5 hours in the early part of the 2000s, and now it's up to about 5.5 hours per day. That's per person. If you do it on a household level, the average household all combined has a TV on somewhere north of 8 hours a day,
wow,
which is most of our waking hours.
It's amazing. Well, Todd, what does this mean for companies that are trying to target young adults?
You know, I think you can reach young adults in a lot of ways, and I don't think it means that the TV is the only way to reach them. Teens are doing a lot of things. But some notion that kids have abandoned, you know, television in general is just patently not true, and it's still a great way for some brands to reach them with their message more than ever. Right? And I think in a world where the digital-type devices are fragmenting people into smaller and smaller ways to reach them with marketing messages, and it gets harder and harder to reach groups of people at once, it actually makes TV that much more attractive.
Todd Younger is a senior analyst with Sanford Bernstein, who wrote this report on how much we're all watching television and using other devices to spend time with our eyes looking at screens. Todd, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
And finally, Stacey, to the UK, where the government is considering changing the rules for ice cream trucks. For decades, playing music after 7 p.m. has been banned on ice cream trucks there, or as the law calls them, vehicles being used for the conveyance of a perishable commodity for human consumption. You know, next time I go out for ice cream, I'm going to say I want to go out for a perishable commodity for human consumption. But anyway, now the government in the UK wants to allow the music on the trucks to be played until 8 p.m., which is interesting. But when I saw this, the first thing I thought of was I had a friend who told me years ago that his mom used to tell him that when he was a kid, that when the ice cream truck came by and that it was playing music, that that meant that they were out of ice cream.
Oh!
He was wondering, why do they never have any ice cream?
That is some mom Jedi mind trick magic. That's pretty smart.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, and this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.